Welcome to the Aesthetic Doctor Podcast. We don't shy away and keep secrets here. We empower you with education, telling you the truth about all things aesthetic medicine, while encouraging you to be the best version of yourself. It's time to look great and feel good doing it. This is your host, mom, speaker, and board-certified physician, Dr. Judith Forger.
Hello, friends, and welcome to episode 59 of the Aesthetic Doctor Podcast. Today, we are talking about the art and science of rhinoplasty. Yes, rhinoplasty or nose surgery, which is the most commonly performed cosmetic surgery in the world. And our guest today is a nationally known expert in rhinoplasty, Dr. Kirk Lozada. Dr. Kirk Lozada is a double board certified facial plastic surgeon and rhinoplasty specialist from Philadelphia. He is a clinical associate in the Department of Facial Plastic Surgery at Penn Medicine. He specializes in scarless rhinoplasty, revision rhinoplasty, and aesthetic surgery of the face and neck. He is the editor of two textbooks on rhinoplasty and non-surgical rejuvenation of the face and neck. So I'm so excited to have Dr. Lozada here, and we are going to be talking all about rhinoplasty. Please enjoy our conversation. As I said in my intro, we are so excited to have another nationwide expert here, Dr. Kirk Lozada. And really, the reason we're talking about rhinoplasty is because rhinoplasty, on my last research, was still the most commonly performed plastic surgery in the world. Mm-hmm. How many rhinoplasties did you do about in a year?
In about a year. So sometimes it varies a little bit week to week, but sometimes some weeks I'm doing up to even 5 or 6 a week. So it can get very busy. So usually I'm between around 120, if not a little bit more per year. It's a lot. It's enough. Let's put it that way.
Yeah. And I mean, again, we want to make sure that you're not a conveyor belt and every patient gets their extension. You do some really difficult surgeries as well. Yeah. As both a sort of a revision expert. And we'll talk about revisions in a little bit.
Yeah, I'll say this to that exact thing that you're saying is that I'm not a super old guy and I'm younger than I look. I think some people are always surprised that I have 3 kids of my own, but it's one of those things that I've kind of grown into a practice where I'm busy enough and I can only really do 2 a day. It mentally kind of maxes me out. I spend all of every moment in a rhinoplasty, you have to be really keyed in and clued in. And so at the end of 2, I'm pretty spent. So I could do more, but I feel like I'd be harming the results for each person. And at this point too, I put enough out there that I'm not trying to do more. Like you said, I'm trying to deliver that end product. And it's not just the surgery, it's the aftercare. It's being able to chat with the patient and being available and all those things. And so the more you do, you just lose that. And so I don't really want to lose that. It's kind of nice.
Yeah, I feel that same thing in my aesthetic practice. I call it a boutique practice simply for that same reason. It doesn't even have anything to do with numbers. It's really just that feel that I never want to lose that focus on my individual patient and on making them really, really special.
That's absolutely true. And they feel it, but it makes all the difference. It really does.
So going through rhinoplasty, obviously rhinoplasty is surgical correction or enhancement of the nose before really going all the way to the basic model of what it means. Will you just start us out with what are some of the reasons why people come to you for getting a rhinoplasty?
So I would say the 2 main reasons are, and they tend to blend, but one reason is function. So breathing and things that just aren't working in the nose. So that's a big thing. And that tends to blend with the cosmetic side, but I think function. And then the other thing is cosmetic, or I would call shape. Shape is definitely one of the main things that I do more and more and more, but the breathing component, the function of it is really important. Because even if someone comes in just for the shape of the nose and the look of the nose, you always have to have that in the back of your mind, because form and function go together in the surgery. It's very, very critical. And so I always say to people that if I gave someone a really cute looking nose that they like, but it doesn't work, I would consider that a personal failure, even if they're happy with it, because the breathing is so important. Those 2 things come together and blend. But in terms of the shape, the most common things that we tend to see are things that people see in their nose that they don't like. So it's a shape that they don't like, a bump that they see that they don't like, a tip that's either too big or too droopy. And again, it's just kind of like a picture and a shape that someone has in their head. They catch themselves in the mirror or a selfie. They don't like X. And then they see other people that have shapes of Y and they're like, I like that more than mine. So I would love to have something more towards that kind of a shape. And so that's really what drives them. And most people have an idea, I think, of what they have in mind. And we do the morphing in the office. So it's very easy to, I think, get to the same, like where they are and where I am in the head. And then we get to the same point because they have a good idea where they're like, yep, that's it. That's what I've been seeing in my mind. Very rarely people don't really know. I would say that's more uncommon more than anything. People just kind of know what they don't like and what they are envisioning in their head, even if they haven't fully seen it yet. So, but those are the main things: bumps, big tips, droopy tips, and just the wrong kind of position overall.
Awesome. And so when we talk about a rhinoplasty, so first of all, do you do them in the office or do you do them in a surgery center? Is there full anesthesia? Is it local? Is it moderate? How does the anesthesia component and the location work?
So I do a lot of procedures in the office when, you know, they're awake with just very minimal, either local anesthesia or whatnot. But rhinoplasty is a surgery overall, I would say across the world and across the country, is predominantly done asleep. So you're going to sleep, you have a breathing tube, general anesthesia. There are a few people in this country and certainly around the world that will do it with kind of more sedation, kind of think of like getting a colonoscopy. You're going kind of like you're out of it, but you don't have a breathing tube per se. I'd say that's the minority and that's more rare. And the real reason is because whenever you do things inside the nose, even though it doesn't tend to bleed a lot, especially if you know what you're doing, there's always a risk that there can be bleeding in the nose. And we all know when you get a nosebleed, like it bleeds like stink, right? And so it can bleed a little and a little bit goes back and that can become an airway risk. It's kind of, for most people, it's not worth putting someone's life at risk, right? For doing something that could be just totally controlled by just going to sleep and having an airway. It's definitely the most common way. So I think going to sleep is just the standard, I would say, at this point. Not that it's wrong otherwise, but...
And I love that you mentioned that because, of course, like I knew the answer to the question, but it's just more for our listeners out there because you know, the nose does affect your airway and the nose is part of your airway. So really having your airway controlled while you're having surgery on a part of the airway is most often seen as the safest thing out there.
Yep, absolutely.
All right. So what are sort of the basic steps to a rhinoplasty? Let's say I come in and even though I don't exactly love my nose, I'm not a rhinoplasty considering it. Let's say I actually wanted to do something about my nose. I've not considered it, but let's pretend that I wanted to. What are the basic steps that you're going to do for, let's say, that one bump or the fact that my nose curves a little that way and I want it perfectly straight? What are the basic steps?
So the basic steps are you need to get to the structural components. Again, we talked about it's all about shape, right? Your nose has shape X and we're trying to get to shape Y. So we need to get to the structural components of what are causing that shape or what the shape is. And so you need to get directly onto the bone and the cartilage. Those are the two things that are making a certain shape and we need to change those. So however you access, there's a lot of things between types of rhinoplasty, open or closed, scarless or open, whatever it is. But either way, you're getting to the structure and the shape. So they're getting onto the bone and the cartilage to see it. And then you need to start changing the shape. So the way to kind of think about, and we'll talk, and I think this will help kind of with the rest of the discussion, but the good way to kind of think about the nose is in three parts. So the top third of your nose up here is bone and everyone can feel that that's hard. And then the middle third here is more soft. It's kind of movable. It's cartilage. And then there's the tip of the nose down low, the lower third, and that's cartilage as well. And so the bump typically that people have, I'll say this, for me when doing rhinoplasty, I think the most common, step one, you get in, you see what the shape is, so you can get access to this stuff. Number two, most people start by taking a bump down. You bring the bump down to the height that you want. From the side, if you have a bump up here, you're bringing that down. Most of the bumps are cartilage and bone. It can be a little bit of a variance of either, but you need to shave the bone down. Either you basically kind of take some of it off or you can shave it down, but you're shaving the bony height down to where you want it. And you can't shave cartilage in the middle part if there's part of that bump. So that you need to cut or trim. You need to get that at the same height and the height that you want. Then you need to make it smooth. And then once you get the bony height down, then you're really kind of going for the most common simplistic rhinoplasties. Then you're going and then you're saying, okay, now I need to go to the tip. I need to affect the shape of the tip. So that means looking from the front, what the shape of the tip is. And then once you get the shape that you want, then you need to say, okay, compared to the position or the height of the bridge, I need to then set the height of the tip. So you have the height of the bridge and the height of the tip. And those two things, you have the components to play with on the profile. And then you've changed the shape of the tip. Now you need to place the position of the tip and how that balances with the height of the bridge. And then, you know, sounds simple, but then you're pretty much done. Changing the straightening of the nose is very complicated. It gets much more in depth. Most of the straightening twists can be in, because of the bone up top, but they tend to be a mix of the bone being somewhat twisted. And then it's also the septum, which gets a little bit complicated of what that is and how it goes. I have a ton of analogies in the office of how I talk about it. But really what it is it's a piece of cartilage on the inside. It's kind of like a wall. And that cartilage itself is typically twisted too. So if it's twisted, and just like we know our ear, even if it has a shape, it doesn't just stay. It has memory. So you really need to kind of almost like a construction project, reshape it or resupport it to get it straighter. There's a lot more complicated involved in that, but that might be a component within that, trying to get it straight before you then set the tip shape and position and all that stuff. But that's pretty much it overall. I mean, that's kind of the general concepts of how you do a rhinoplasty.
And you kind of mentioned a couple rhinoplasty sort of different techniques. Would you just go over the big kind of categories of different like techniques? I know there's open, there's closed, there's all this stuff. And especially I think too, as people get more and more social media savvy, as they get more and more Google savvy, they see things, but they might not quite understand like what it means. So would you just discuss the basic like types of techniques for us?
Right. So when you hear about open or closed or scarless, or I guess not scarless, whatever those terms are, all that's referring to is access. All it's referring to is how someone gets in to see the bone and the cartilage to change shape. So that's all it really is. It's not really referring to what they're going to do to the bump or to the tip or those things. Some things are easier and harder, but that's basically the way it is. It's just basically access. So an open rhinoplasty, basically down here at the base of your nose, kind of at the thinnest point here, you make a little incision here, and then every incision otherwise is inside the nose so that you can pull the skin up, kind of like the hood of a Volkswagen or the hood of a buggy, right? And then everything lifts up, and then you have, when you look straight down, you see everything that you need. You're looking straight down at the cartilages of your tip, the middle part, and the bone. So you can see it all, and that's open rhinoplasty. And scarless or closed rhinoplasty, basically the only thing you don't do is that you don't make this little incision here. We make the same kind of incisions on the inside of the nostrils. We make another incision further in. And what that does is it allows us to get access to the bridge. And then we can also manipulate the shape of the tip, these cartilages, but you don't get to look straight down in the way that they normally like sit without touching them and just seeing them, oh, they look like this shape or this position. What we have to do is you have to pull them out of the nostrils to then modify shape and then put them back in. Again, you can kind of imagine if you're doing like a crafts project or a construction project of some sort, and you never got to see the shape of it as it's really sitting, that's presenting a certain set of challenges to it, right? And maybe you wouldn't want to do that. You could imagine in certain circumstances and others. The main takeaway from all of that is the approach doesn't guarantee a result. And the approach is not, one is not better than the other. It's a Mac or PC debate. So what I tell my patients is, if I say that I'm going to do something closed or scarless, but my best friend out in California said that he's going to do it open, we're both right as long as you like that result in the end that they get. We're both right. So there's many ways to get to the same end result. But it's just access. And certain things make certain things easier. Some things make it harder. And sometimes at the end of the case, I've had to kind of think more about a certain kind of subset of things because I did it open or I did it closed. You just have to get used to it. And so closed tends to be harder, I would say, for people just because you don't see as well. And people don't train to do it as often in the United States as in Europe, South America, and other places. It just depends on how you're trained and what your experience level is. But most people do open, less people do closed. And again, it's just one of those things. But that's basically kind of in general when you see things of how to kind of think about it.
I love that. Thank you. So we have talked a lot about it. And one of the things that I really hone in on my podcast is that aesthetic medicine is medicine. It's art, it's science, it's beauty. It's sort of all of the things blended together. And my firm belief is that with anything aesthetically, you should really go to the best person that you can. Like, there is never in my mind a sort of advantage to trying to save some money And especially to that safety and expertise are so important. And that's why I also love having people like yourself there that are true experts, experts in the field, so that people can really learn and understand and also see why somebody like you has the status that he does, has the training that he does, has the expertise, has the appointments, and yes, is worth whatever it is that you charge. And I don't know what you charge. What makes in your kind of thought a really, really good rhinoplasty surgeon?
So what you said is so true. And it's one of those really interesting things. I'm not so priced out for people's budget that I'm catering just to a specific type of person or whatnot. Rhinoplasty is expensive, whatever way you dice it. But one of the things that I would say too, that crossed my mind when you said that, is just that like, price does not equal quality. So, and you know that, and you said that many times, and that's true. Just because you're going to pay or someone's going to charge you a certain number of dollars, it doesn't mean that you're going to get that level of result or that it's expected or that reflects on how good they are. It can, but it doesn't work that way either. And so it makes it a little bit tougher as a consumer to figure out who to choose, right? And like, to judge on who's good or not, whether that's to get your lips filled or to get certain skincare treatments or rhinoplasty. But what I would say is that you really can't fake reviews and you can't fake photos. If you're choosing anyone, even for injections or a rhinoplasty, reading reviews and seeing photos of what it is, those you can't fake. And so the price tag.
Well, you can't fake photos. Let's
you can fake photos, but I think you can fake photos, but I will say, I guess in the realm of rhinoplasty, you really can't fake photos. Like you can to an extent, but I think it's pretty hard to fake them consistently. If you have a good number of photos, consistency and whatnot, I think that is probably the thing that's going to help a consumer, you know, whoever's listening to this. I'd say those two things are probably the best bet. And beyond that, you've done the best you can. You meet the person and you hopefully you vibe with them, you trust them, and that's where it is. The difficulty with rhinoplasty that I've found having done this, because I do a lot of other surgeries too. But the difficulty with rhinoplasty compared to like a facelift, let's say, if you do a facelift and maybe you don't do a lot of facelifts and maybe the facelift you're doing isn't going that great or whatever it is that's happening, right? If you go in and you do a facelift, it's very hard to have it come out really bad. Like even if you don't do the most in-depth complicated facelift, you're going to get a nice result. Like it's going to improve certain parts and it's going to be nice. Like it may not be as good as maybe someone was hoping or you were hoping, but it's going to look better. You're going to do a good job. Rhinoplasty is one of those really weird surgeries that is very unforgiving. If you don't really understand and you don't really know or realize or understand how to kind of like make sure that something looks a certain way, it can punish you and it can make something small become a really big problem and you can be out of your depth very, very quickly. And that person, even well-intentioned, can then be needing a revision for something that they had no idea. That's frustrating for patients and it's frustrating for surgeons. And the reason why is because what makes a really good rhinoplasty surgeon, I say this in the office, I say, if you go and see anyone who does enough nose surgery, they can pull out 6 or 7 good before and afters. Like you should have enough before and afters where you're like, okay, here's a good subset of before and afters. If I went to like a conference with some of my friends and I said, okay, guys, let's all get on a panel and let's show our last 10 rhinoplasties, like the last 10 you did, I bet that some people would be a little touchy to like show those. The reason being is that it's not about having good results. It's about having consistent results within different noses and different shapes. If someone has a formula of how they do rhinoplasty and they do it, they're like, this is how I do a nose. It's the only way I do a nose. Even if they're really, really good at it, you might be great for 70% of those, that they fit your model really, really well. Those shapes fit it and you do it really well. But there are going to be a subset, whether that's 10 or 15 or 30% of the patients, where it just doesn't look as good and it's not as good, or it's really not good. And then they're going to need revisions. You have to be malleable to what the different nose shapes are like and understand what they need and have basically what I say is a big tool belt to understand that, like I said, shape X to Y, here are my set of tools. Did that do what I wanted it to? If not, I go to the next thing and I go to the next thing, and you can't be formulaic about it. And you have to be kind of malleable during the surgery to understand that it's going to take something different for every nose is different. And like I say to patients too in the office, you've probably looked on Google Images and all these things. You've never found your own nose. It doesn't exist because your nose is truly unique. And there's certain things about it that just are different than anyone else's. I know it's a long-winded answer, but that's kind of the answer that I give people.
I love it. I love it. And you kind of talked a little about revision. And I know that revisions are super difficult because there's only a certain amount of bone and cartilage really in the nose that provides the structure. And once that is gone, it's gone or it's shaved down too much or it can't support the nose. And we obviously all still know Michael Jackson and the difficulties he had with his nose, right? Yep. Like, but there's lots of other examples, but yep. What makes a revision so difficult? And this is really to say that choose the right surgeon the first time.
Yeah. I mean, it's one of those things. It's definitely not one to bargain hunt for any surgery. Like you said, any procedure, it's not worth bargain hunting. It's not worth Grouponing, even Botox, right? It's not worth it. Revision surgery in general is difficult because the first time someone's been somewhere, you're going to get scar tissue and you're going to get scarring. Revision nose surgery is extremely difficult and extremely complicated potentially just because the first time rhinoplasty is a heart surgery. It's making it more difficult. Now, why is that? It's because I think if I really had to give an honest answer, thinking about it, bone has a shape and a like strength to it, but the cartilage is really the thing that's really interesting. And I think there's probably other surgeries out there, but rhinoplasty is one of the few where you're dealing a lot with cartilage and shaping it and trying to keep it in a certain shape and doing those things. And that's pretty difficult to do. And if you're needing a revision, it's showing that something didn't work. And now you're trying to make it work again in the field of scar tissue and scarring. And you're only going to make that worse. What you tend to have to do is you really have to create something with support and strength in a revision. And typically what I find is that people aren't providing that level of support and strength the first time. So they're either not fixing the things that needed to be fixed with strength and support, or they're damaging, like you said, they're removing or damaging cartilage so much that that's caused the problem. Or it's just the plan of action didn't work and wasn't right for the presented shape problem that was there. And so that's what I would say the most, but it's really just that. And then the last thing is that, especially if it's not your own revision, you just never know what you're gonna find in there. If you're a revision surgeon in the nose, you need to basically be prepared for anything. You need to be prepared to not just fix, but replace anything in the nose. You have to assume that someone left no tip and you have to be able to go in and be like, okay, if there's no tip, I'm going to replace the whole thing. And that's a lot. So you never really know what you're going to find. And a lot of times, and I'd say in almost every revision, sometimes at the end, I'm like, I'm not sure how I got from point A to Z, but it's solving problem at a time. And then by the end, you're making it all work in some harmonious balance thing. So
that's awesome. I had another question. So when you do rhinoplasties, do you mostly do them by themselves or do you a lot of times because you're a facial plastic surgeon do them as part of like a facelift, a neck lift, whatever other surgery?
So I tend to do them more on their own. I will sometimes add it to other smaller procedures. So like a rhinoplasty and a chin implant make a lot of sense for facial balancing purposes. And whether that's liposuction in the neck or buccal fat removal or smaller procedures like a bleft, yes. A facelift and a neck lift and a rhinoplasty, I tend not to. I did one of those early on in my career and I was like, that was not a good idea. And I tried to keep it as a simple nose too. Like I was trying to be like, oh, it's a simple thing. And then I think it's one of those reminders that no nose is simple. Like I said, for me, a nose is like a 2.5 hour, very mentally demanding thing. A facelift is the opposite. It's a very physically demanding thing because you're doing 1, 2, 3 physical surgeries, a lot of suturing, a lot of those things. So it's a very different thing. It's not as mental. It's not as like those kind of things. But for me, I don't think I can give the best result, honestly, if I'm doing too much. For me, a face and a neck and a rhino is a little too much. There's a lot of people that do it. It's not the wrong thing. Everyone just got to know like what their limit is and what they think they can deliver the best results for. Not to say that I wouldn't do it ever if the right patient comes along, but usually I tend to recommend separating those procedures. Yeah, just for me. But there are other people that do it and they do it very well.
What is the average downtime and recovery like from a patient's perspective after rhinoplasty?
I will say there's some variance here, and it's taken me a good amount of time to get to the point now in our practice where patients tend to heal very, very quickly and do very, very well. I can't promise this is across the board, but for me, really, like, I see people 5 or 6 days after their surgery. I take their casts off. If anything is inside the nose, like little plastic stents or sheets, we take those out, we suction the nose clear, and they're feeling great after that. And they're back to work that day or the next day. So it's really a week. I always say by 2 weeks, you could walk down the street and no one would know you had a big surgery. And a lot of times that's even close to that 1 week period too. It doesn't mean that they're not noticing that their nose is puffy and a little swollen, but like they're not turning heads. I always say it's not like hit them with a baseball bat and they're like looking crazy. Now you can go out and find pictures of that on the internet. And I see patients that come to me for revisions and they've showed me pictures. I had one recently. She showed me her first rhinoplasty recovery pictures, like even through weeks and months. And I was like, whoa. She's like, was that normal? I was like, no. You might get a variance, but again, someone that posts their immediate pictures tells you a lot too. My immediate before and afters with their black backgrounds, like those tell you that the nose is going to look pretty good right away. Why? Because there is not a lot of bruising. There's not a lot of swelling. If you can see that shape in right away, then you know that you've taken care of the things that give you the bruising and the swelling, which are the skin. So you want to be away from the skin and the muscle. You want to be on the cartilage and bone, and that takes the right way to access those structures. And if you really take care of those well, then that makes the recovery better. It makes there's less bruising and swelling. Even if I've never met somebody personally, and I don't know how they do their surgery, if I see their immediate before and afters, I know that I can be like, that person knows what's up. They know how to take care of those things. Those are going to get good results because you can just see it. It's there for you. You can't fake those things. But it's typically a week, and then they're kind of just on doing life and just kind of like being patient. And there's certain things that we do after, but they're really back to it after a week. So it's not as bad as most people think.
How do you feel about all the non-surgical rhinoplasties that people do with like threads, with fillers, all of that stuff?
I don't do threads, but I certainly do a lot of liquid rhinoplasty in my practice too. I think it's perfect. I mean, I think it's a great tool. Just like filler for someone that is not wanting a facelift surgery, but they want to kind of camouflage and use volume shifts to really help improve their appearance. It's perfect, right? It's exactly what it's giving them a solution for a problem that they don't want to necessarily go all the way down the road for, right? There's certainly patients, revisions patients, where you can do little kind of things with liquid rhinoplasty that kind of give them that boost of confidence, take that thing that they don't really like and make it quickly go away. And then there's a lot of patients that if you can get a little drop of filler in their nose here and there, and it's doing exactly what they want, why not? It is certainly cheaper. It's not less risky. I mean, there's a risk for liquid rhinoplasty, as we know, but it's certainly less risky in terms of like things that can happen during a rhinoplasty or little things that can come up. So I love it. When people are perfect fits for liquid rhinos, I think it's great. Now, threading in general, there's a huge thing about threads, but I always kind of go back to one of our big gurus in facial plastics, who's Mike Nyack, who everyone knows and loves. And you know, about threads, he always says, people say that threads lift. There's better ways of lifting, which is surgery. And then if they say that threads volumize, there's better ways to volumize, which is filler. So I don't quite get threads in the nose. I'm not really sure how that works, but filler makes perfect sense.
And yeah,
But people are so happy with liquid rhinos. Do you inject the nose?
Yes. And yep. I do it ultrasound guided. Like, again, we've talked about why cartilage is so hard. And for everybody listening, cartilage has not the best blood supply, right? Which is why we're always worried about regeneration and also the blood supply to the nose. So I will do it. I'm fairly conservative. So I do it ultrasound guided. I don't have 300 mid-levels doing it, but I feel like with ultrasound guided and good before and after, and again, in the right patient with a clear expectation, I do it, like you said, because rhinoplasty is not an option for everybody, right? First of all, sometimes the defect isn't big enough. Sometimes they're not a surgical candidate. Sometimes they can't or don't want the downtime. It's a significant difference in cost, right? I do a little bit of it in patients that I feel are the right patients. Do I do hundreds of noses? Absolutely not. But in the right patients with the right expectations and the right defect, yes, ultrasound guided, I will put some drops of filler in there because a lot of times it is just a little bump or a little this or a little that, right?
And I think, would you say, especially in terms of my experience, that I think you probably would experience this too, as opposed to doing filler in all locations that you can put it in the face, like those patients for a few drops in the radix or right above to take a little bump away, it really doesn't take much filler, doesn't take much time. And those people are some of the happiest people, right? They're out of the chair, they are pumped, right? You've taken something that was their insecurity away in minutes. And it's really nice to be part of that. And it's a very quick thing. So I do love those patients.
Like you said, it lasts a long time because there's really no forces on it. So like just even your 0.01 or your point, like whatever, like because they're tiny amounts, like it lasts a long time.
It really does. It really does. So I love it.
Yeah. So tell me, what separates you from all the plastic surgeons and what makes you amazing? Because you clearly are.
So I would say, well, thank you for that, number one. I don't claim to be unique among all the rhinoplasty surgeons or better than anyone else, but there's certainly some really, really great rhinoplasty surgeons around the world and the country that are a lot of my friends. Luckily, I get to call them too. I think being honest, knowing kind of like the behind the scenes insider kind of view, if you will, I think getting a rhinoplasty surgeon, what makes the difference, I think, is a rhinoplasty surgeon that's really honest with themselves and their results and is always trying to, and basically is not someone that's trying to be like a cookie cutter result and doing kind of the same things and is always trying to do different things. So we do morphing in the office, right? And I actually send that data of the morphing to a company that makes some post-op splints that are 3D printed. And they also make some other things. So they see the data of all the things that I say. And the CEO of the company one day told me, she was like, when you morph the noses, they're not the same. She's like, some people, they have like a nose, a type, and it varies predictable. She's like, we've noticed that yours are always different. And I took that as a very big compliment because I feel like I'm very able to balance someone's nose for their face and make it look natural. And the only way I was able to like, get here to do that is by doing a lot of it, but also being really honest of being like, okay, if something didn't work, why? And not just accepting it as being like, oh, you know, there's going to be a certain percentage of people where these things don't work. Because I think it's very easy to fall into that trap. Even if like take lip injections, right? Be like, oh, it's just a hard lip. Like they're not good for filler. Like you could say that, but you could also really try to be honest with yourself and be like, okay, but why? Could I do better? Could I figure out what other technique I could learn? Or maybe to say to that person, lip injections aren't actually the best option for you. Maybe that's the learning experience, right? But I think that makes all the difference because then you're really a flexible surgeon and you're really able to kind of deliver more personal results, listen to what they're looking for. And I think that makes all the difference, honestly. So kind of not practicing self-deception, being honest, and really always trying to do the best each moment and for each patient and just not assuming that everything's going to be great just because you do it.
Well, thank you so much. First of all, thank you for all that you do. And thank you for coming on to really help our listeners understand rhinoplasty. And it was an interesting conversation. So thank you so much for giving us your time. Now, I have actually followed you, and I told you this for years, and you have a great social media. You have a really fun, humorous like Instagram and TikTok. So we're obviously going to link all of your information in the show notes so people know how to find you. And again, in the world of plastic surgery, like traveling to see somebody for an amazing result is something very, very feasible. Will you just tell us where people can best find you?
Yep. So my practice location is here right in Philly, in Philadelphia, in the USA. It's a big city here on the East Coast, and I've been here a long time. I do love the city quite a bit. You can find me, my website's drkirklozada.com. Everything of mine is all basically Dr. Kirk Lozada. So my Instagram is drkirklozada, and same on TikTok. And there's, again, a lot of patient reviews, a lot of photos, all those things, everything I try to put out there as much as possible, but you can certainly reach out to us and I'm here. I'd love to see you in the office and kind of talk about whatever.
Well, thank you again and have a wonderful day. Thank you.
You too. Thanks so much for having me on. I really appreciate it. It was fun.
Thank you for listening to the Aesthetic Doctor Podcast with Dr. Judith Forger. We'd love to connect with you outside of the show. Follow Dr. Borger on Instagram at Dr. Borger and find more online and ways to work with Dr. Borger at www.theaestheticdoctor.com. Until next time, be well.